Chapter 37. The business jet circled the airfield once, waiting for a small plane to take off and clear the field before the control tower gave approval to land. Painted in the same shade of turquoise as its fellow sea vessels, the Numa Hawker 750 touched down lightly on the runway. The small jet taxied to a red brick building before pulling to a halt alongside a much larger Gulfstream G650. The fuselage door opened and Pitt quickly stepped out, slipping on a jacket to ward off a brisk chill in the air. He walked into the terminal building, where he was greeted by a rotund man standing behind a counter. "Welcome to Elliott Lake. It's not often we have two jets in on the same day," he said in a friendly, rural voice. "A little short for the carriers?" Pitt asked. "Our runway is only 4,500 feet, but we hope to expand it next year. Can I fix you up with a rental car?" Pitt nodded and soon left the terminal with a set of keys to a blue Ford SUV. Spreading a map on the hood of the car, he studied his new surroundings. Elliott Lake was a small town near the northeast shores of Lake Huron. Situated some 275 miles due north of Detroit, the town lay in the Algoma district of Ontario Province. Surrounded by Canadian wilderness, the landscape was a lush mix of rugged mountains, winding rivers, and deep lakes. Pitt found the airport on his map, carved out of the dense forest a few miles south of the town. He traced a lone highway that traveled south through the mountains, culminating on the shores of Lake Huron and the Trans-Canada Highway. About 15 miles to the west was Pitt's destination, an old logging and mining town called Blind River. The drive was scenic, the road winding past several mountain lakes and a surging river that dropped over a steep waterfall. The terrain flattened as he reached the shores of Lake Huron and the town of Blind River. He drove slowly through the small hamlet, admiring the quaint wood homes, which were mostly built in the 1930s. Pitt continued past the city limits until spotting a large steel warehouse adjacent to a field littered with high mounds of rock and ore. A large maple leaf flag flew above a weathered sign that read Ontario Miners Co-op and Repository. Pitt turned in and parked near the entrance as a broad-shouldered man in a brown suit walked down the steps and climbed into a late-model white sedan. Pitt noticed the man stare at him through a pair of dark sunglasses as he climbed out of his own rental car and entered the building. The dusty interior resembled a mining museum. Rusty ore carts and pickaxes jammed the corners alongside high shelves that overflowed with mining journals and old photographs. Behind a long wooden counter sat a massive antique banker's safe that Pitt guessed held the more valuable mineral samples. Seated behind the counter was an older man who appeared almost as dusty as the room's interior. He had a bulb-shaped head, and his gray hair, eyes, and mustache matched the faded flannel shirt he wore beneath a pair of striped suspenders. He peered at Pitt through a pair of Ben Franklin glasses perched low on his nose. "Good morning," Pitt said, introducing himself. Gazing up at a polished tin container that resembled a large liquor flask, he remarked, "Beautiful old oil catcher you have there." The old man's eyes lit up as he realized Pitt wasn't a lost tourist looking for directions. "Yep, used to refill the early miners' oil lamps. Came from the nearby Bruce Mines. My grandpappy worked the copper mines there till they shut down in 1921, he said in a wheezy voice. "A lot of copper in these hills?" Pitt asked. "Not enough to last long. Most of the copper and gold mines shut down decades ago. Attracted a lot of dirt diggers in their day, but not too many folks got rich from it," he replied, shaking his head. Looking Pitt in the eye, he asked, "What can I do for you today?" "I'd like to know about your stock of ruthenium." "Ruthenium?" he asked, looking at Pitt queerly. "You with that big fella that was just in here?" "No," Pitt replied. He recalled the odd behavior of the man in the brown suit and tried to shake off a nagging sense of familiarity. "That's peculiar," the man said, eyeing Pitt with suspicion. "That other fellow was from the Natural Resources Ministry in Ottawa. Here checking our supply and sources of ruthenium. Odd that it was the only mineral he was interested in, and you come walking in asking about the same thing."
"Did he tell you his name?"
John Booth, I believe he said. A bit of an odd bird, I thought. Now, what's your interest, Mr. Pitt? Pitt generally explained Lisa Lane's research at George Washington University and ruthenium's role in her scientific work. He neglected to disclose the magnitude of her recent discovery or the recent explosion at the lab. Yes, I recall sending a sample to that lab a week or two ago. We don't get too many requests for ruthenium, just a few public research labs and the occasional high-tech company. With the price going so crazy, not too many folks can afford to dabble with it anymore. Of course, that price spike has made us a nice profit when we do get an order, he smiled with a wink. I just wish we had a source to replenish our inventory. You don't have an ongoing supplier? Oh, heavens, no, not in years. I reckon my stock will be depleted before long. We used to get some from a platinum mine in eastern Ontario, but the ore they're pulling out now isn't showing any meaningful content. No, as I was telling Mr. Booth, most of our ruthenium stocks came from the Inuit. They mined it up north? Pitt asked. Apparently so. I pulled the acquisition records for Mr. Booth, he said, pointing to an ancient leather-bound journal sitting at the other end of the counter. The stuff was acquired over 100 years ago. There's a detailed accounting in the logbook. The Inuit referred to it as the Black Kabluna, or some such. We always called it the Adelaide sample, as the Inuit were from a camp on the Adelaide Peninsula in the Arctic. So that's the extent of the Canadian supply of ruthenium? As far as I know. But nobody knows if there's more to the Inuit source. It all surfaced so long ago. The story was that the Inuit were afraid to return to the island where they obtained it because of a dark curse. Something about bad spirits and the source being tainted by death and insanity, or similar mumbo-jumbo. A tall tale of the north, I guess. I've found that local legends often have some basis in fact, Pitt replied. Do you mind if I take a look at the journal? Not at all. The old geologist ambled down to the end of the counter and returned with the book, flipping through its pages as he walked. A scowl suddenly crossed his face as his skin turned beet red. Santa Maria, he hissed. He tore out the record right in front of me. There was a hand-drawn map of the mine location right there. Now it's gone. The old man slammed the book to the counter while turning an angry eye toward the door. Pitt could see where two pages had been neatly torn from the journal. I'd venture to say that your Mr. Booth isn't who he said he was, Pitt said. I should have suspected something when he didn't know what a sluice box was, the man grumbled. I don't know why he had to deface our records. He could have just asked for a copy. Pitt knew the reason why. Mr. Booth didn't want anyone else to know the source of the Inuit ruthenium. He slid the journal around and read a partial entry ahead of the missing pages. October 22, 1917. Horace Tucker of the Churchill Trading Company consigned following unrefined ore quantities. 5 tons of copper ore, 12 tons of lead ore, 2 tons of zinc, 1/4 ton of ruthenium, Adelaide Black Kabluna. Source and assayer comments to follow. That was the only Inuit shipment you've received? Pitt asked. The old man nodded. That was it. The missing pages indicated that the mineral had actually been obtained decades earlier. That trading post in Churchill couldn't find a market for the stuff until Tucker brought a sample in with some minerals from a mine in Manitoba. Any chance the Churchill Trading Company records still exist? Pretty doubtful. They went out of business back around 1960. I met Tucker a few years later in Winnipeg shortly before he died. I remember him telling me how the old log trading post in Churchill had burned to the ground. I would imagine their trading records were destroyed in the fire. I guess that's the end of the line, then. I'm sorry about the theft of your data, but thank you for sharing what you know. Hold on a second, the man replied. He stepped over and opened the thick door to the ancient safe. He rummaged around a wooden bin inside, then turned and tossed something to Pitt. It was a tiny, smooth stone, silvery white in color. Black Kabluna? He asked. A sample on the house, so that you know what we've been talking about. Pitt reached across the counter and shook hands with the geologist, thanking him for his time. One more thing, the old man said as Pitt strolled toward the door. You run into that Booth fella. You be sure and tell him I'm coming after him with a pickaxe if I ever see him again. The afternoon had turned colder under the cast of an approaching front, and Pitt waited anxiously for the car heater to warm up as he exited the co-op's parking lot. Grabbing a quick lunch at a cafe in Blind River, he drove back through the winding mountain road toward the airport, contemplating the Inuit ruthenium tale. The ore had to have come from the Arctic, presumably near the Inuit camp at Adelaide. How had the Inuit, with primitive technology, mined the ruthenium? Were there still significant reserves in place? And who was John Booth, and why was he interested in the Inuit ore? The questions brought no answers as he wound through the scenic hills, braking as he pulled up behind a slower-moving RV. Reaching a straight stretch in the road, the RV driver pulled to the shoulder and waved for Pitt to pass. Pitt stomped on the accelerator and sped past the motorhome, which he noted had a Colorado license plate. The road snaked sharply ahead of him, the two lanes carving into the edge of a rocky mountainside that tumbled down to a river below. Twisting through a tight bend, Pitt could see the roadway a mile ahead, where the highway nearly doubled back on a parallel facing. Parked in a turnout, he caught glimpse of a white sedan. It was the same vehicle that John Booth had climbed into at the co-op. Pitt lost sight of the car as the roadway bended and twisted once more. Rounding through a tight S-curve, the road straightened again for a short stretch. To Pitt's left, the hillside plunged in a steep drop-off, falling several hundred feet to the river below. As his rental car gained speed on the straightaway, Pitt heard a faint pop, like the burst of a distant 4th of July firework. He glanced ahead but noticed nothing, as a deep rumble followed the initial noise. A movement caught his eye and he looked up to see a house-sized boulder sliding down the mountainside above him. The huge rock was falling in a perfect trajectory to intersect with Pitt's car 200 feet down the road. Pitt instantly stomped on the brakes, mashing the pedal to the floorboard. The tires chirped and shimmied in protest, but the car's anti-lock braking system kept the vehicle from skidding uncontrollably. In the brief seconds Pitt waited for the car to stop, he observed that a full landslide was now underway. In addition to the huge rock, a whole wall of rocks and gravel was chasing the boulder down the mountainside. With seemingly half of the mountain barreling toward him, he knew he would have only one chance to escape. His quick braking slowed the car just enough to prevent him from being flattened by the first mammoth boulder. The huge rock hit the asphalt just 20 feet in front of him, splintering into several smaller sections. Most of the rock pieces continued their downhill slide, smashing through the guardrail and tumbling down the steep precipice toward the river. A few large chunks died on the road, soon to be buried by the impeding landslide that followed. Pitt's car skidded into one of the chunks, a flattened slab of granite that instantly stopped his momentum. Though mashing the bumper and grill, the car's mechanics were undamaged. Inside, Pitt only felt a strong jolt, but it was enough to inflate the airbag, which ballooned in front of his chest as the vehicle bounced backward. Pitt's quick senses had beaten the airbag, though. He had already jammed the automatic transmission into reverse and stomped on the accelerator at the moment of impact. The rear tires smoked as they spun wildly before gripping the pavement and propelling the car backward. Pitt gripped the steering wheel and held it steady as the car tried to fishtail from the sudden rearward torque before settling on a stable line. The transmission screamed beneath Pitt's feet as the low-ratio reverse gear fought to maintain revolutions with the floored engine. Pitt glanced up the hill to see the sliding mass of rocks and gravel already descending upon him. The landslide had spread across a wide lane, extending well to his rear. He quickly realized there was no way he could outrun it. Like a slate-colored tidal wave, the sliding wall of rock cascaded onto the roadway, spilling first a few yards in front of him. For an instant, it appeared as if the speeding car might slip past the deluge, but then a separate cluster of boulders broke free and crashed to the road behind him. Pitt could do nothing but hold on as the car barreled into the moving layer of rocks with a screeching peal of twisted metal. The car scraped over a large boulder, snapping off the rear axle and sending one of the drive wheels careening down the hill. Pitt was thrown back into his seat as a secondary wall of falling rocks smashed into the passenger side, lifting the car up and over onto its roof. Pitt was flung to his left, his head striking a side airbag as it inflated. Seconds later, he was jarred to the side again, his head banging through the deflating airbag until striking the driver's side window. A great battering roar filled his ears as the car was pummeled across the road, slamming hard to a sudden stop. Inside, Pitt teetered on the brink of consciousness as the sound of rushing gravel surrounded him. His vision went blurry as he was buffeted in his seat. He vaguely felt a warm wetness to his face, and then all feeling vanished as he dropped into a silent void of blackness.